As we continue this evening, I don't know if you all kept and brought back your sheets from a couple of weeks ago or not. Sarah probably got hers out of the top drawer. It was in your Bible. All right. That's good. Well, you usually leave it in the top drawer. I don't know how many of these I have left here if folks want one. Talking about the world and human nature. We ended a couple of weeks ago, and really it's going to be a little sporadic since we'll meet this evening, and then next week is the hog service. I hope it's cold. Isn't that when it's supposed to be cold when you hang hogs, right? Kill them and hang them. Of course, we won't be hanging hogs. We'll be hanging greens. I have one. But this was from my little notes from the other time. But when we ended last time, and of course, I think it's kind of interesting, I guess, that going to talk some about how we live and human nature and sin. When this morning, First Chronicles, we talked, among other things, about even being thankful for the judgments that we receive. But a couple of weeks ago when we were gathered for this, I kind of gave a preview and said a young boy brought his report card home. He had received rather low marks in conduct. I got an A- in conduct one time. My mother was just all beside herself. It was in the 9th grade. And I asked the teacher, Mrs. Pascal. We didn't say this to her face, but she had teeth like a horse. But but my mother wanted to know why, and so I asked her, and she said, because one day, sitting in class, I sat there the whole time with a smirk on my face. I got an A- in conduct because I had a smirk on my face. I started to say, how can you tell? But he had received rather low marks in conduct. When his father asked him about his low marks, he replied, but Dad, conduct is my hardest subject. Bill Tuck says, and so it is for all of us. Conduct is really our hardest subject in life. And it boils down to our nature and, I guess, to human nature. Walter Rauschenbusch, anyone recognize the name of Rauschenbusch? Rauschenbusch was a Baptist last century. He is given credit with being kind of the founder of the social gospel movement in the early 20th century. Although, actually, Jesus kind of helped found that, and the gospel writer in Luke really pushes it. But Rauschenbusch says, here we have a lengthy quote, sin is not a private transaction between the sinner and God. Humanity always crowds the audience room when God holds court. We must democratize the conception of God. Then the definition of sin will become more realistic. We love and serve God when we love and serve our fellow, whom He loves and in whom He lives. We rebel against God and repudiate His will when we set our profit and ambition above the welfare of our fellows. And maybe it's a little bit serendipitous that quote is here and we're looking at it this evening, right here at Thanksgiving, when we're thinking about self, but also thinking about others. So the questions then come for us. What is the nature of the world around us? That's what it means by external reality. What is the nature of the world around us? Is it perfect? Is it fallen? Yeah. Neutral. There are those who say, it's just totally amoral. Is it an open system or a closed system? Is it an open system in which we can make decisions, or is it a closed system where we don't have that and it doesn't have any influence? All of these figure into our understanding of the world and our understanding of human nature. especially as Christians. Within Christian theism, there is the belief and the teaching that God created ex nihilo, out of nothing, that the cosmos was and is to operate with some sense of uniformity. God built into the system this sense of cause and effect, and therefore it's an open system. What we do will have an effect on us, on others, on the system as a whole. In Genesis, excuse me, I sneezed a while ago and now my nose wants to run. Sad thing is, I don't have to run to catch it. It's right here running around me. But in Genesis chapter 3, the story there of what we call the fall of humanity. Now, it wasn't just the fall of the woman. The man stood there and big, bad, strapping man said, you can go ahead and try it first. Let me see if anything happens to you. But what happens in that fall? Not only do the man and the woman suffer, not only does this relationship between persons and God suffer, the relationship between the man and the woman suffers, does it not? I mean, when God confronts them, the man says, "Oh, well, this woman that you gave to me," that's what he says, "this woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave me the fruit from the tree and I ate." So already there's some friction there. And the woman, of course, later on, she was probably thinking, "You just wait till we get home." But then the woman follows suit and she turns around and she blames the serpent. And then the serpent looks around and there's nobody there to blame. But the interesting thing is the man not only blames the woman, the man's blaming God. He said, "This woman whom you gave to me, if you hadn't given her to me, if you hadn't made her this way and given her to me, it wouldn't happen." But the Lord God said to the serpent, the fall occurs and God says to the serpent, "Because you've done this, cursed are you among all animals and among all wild creatures. Upon your belly you shall go." Hence the explanation as to why snakes crawl on their bellies. Yes, Susan. Well, and good and bad, you'll be just like God, knowing the difference in good and bad. And her response, I think, to the deception is, well, you know, and so the old words, one is, "He beguiled me." That's right. And that's part of the whole thing about she is deceiving herself by saying that the serpent deceived her, the serpent enticed her. And there was that wanting to be like God and know good and bad and all this kind of stuff and yet still have the blessings of God. And then the man participates, so the sin is complete. That's why they know they're naked. The man participates when he sees that nothing happens to her earlier in the story. They're both complicit in this, but she's really deceiving herself, but she's looking for some way to blame the serpent, and she's trying to say, "Well, you know, he really lied to me because I'm really not like you. I've gotten in trouble, so I'm looking for somebody to blame at that particular point in time." So I do think enticement is what really happened, but she's looking for an excuse. Of course, a man just looked for an excuse, right? So are the man and the woman the only ones that suffer? No. The relationship with God suffers. The relationship between themselves suffers. Between the two of them suffers as a result of this fall. And the fall basically is choice. It's choice. They're given a choice to do what God wishes or to do what they want and what they think is the easy way to go or the best way to go. And so it boils down to a choice unless you're a Calvinist and then you got two choices there. As a Calvinist, you can either be an infralapsarian or a supralapsarian. And in one case, God gave man free choice until he found out what the decision would be and then predestined everything after that. To The other view is, well, no, God predetermined everything, including the fall, so that God could be magnanimous to somebody. Okay, God predestined that we would fall. So, but here, you've got all of this going on. It says, cursed are you among all animals, among all wild creatures. Upon your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat all the days of your life. I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and hers. He will strike your head, you will strike his heel. Yahweh's explanation of why people try to kill snakes, and snakes, unless they do climb trees, by the way. But snakes can't strike you too high, but they will. There's this enmity here at the beginning. So he was a serpent, he lost his legs, started crawling on the ground in a rut. Then, to the woman, he said, I will greatly increase your pangs in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband. He shall rule over you. To the man, he said, because you have listened to the voice of your wife, have eaten of the tree about which I commanded you. Remember who's writing this to, guys. But tries to put more stress on the blame of the woman. They were both equally guilty here. Which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread until you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken. You are dust, and to dust you shall return. What suffers? All of creation suffers in the fall. It's not just the man and the woman. It's not just that relationship, but the entire world suffers. All of creation suffers. Yes, Susan. Yes. The man has now become like one of us, knowing good and evil, and now he might reach out his hand and take also. Well, what is really meant here is he's become like us in knowing good and bad, and it could be the entire angelic court. There are many within Christian theism that say, here is evidence of Trinity, because you got the Spirit of God moving over the face of the waters and at the beginning of Genesis chapter 1, and you got God the Father. And so then later reading back into it with John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God and created and all this kind of stuff. So many within Christian theism say, here's evidence of the Trinity because of the us. But for the Hebrew writer, the us here would mean just like we who the heavenly court, which includes the angels, God, the angels, whoever's in the heavenly court, who know the difference between good and evil, and who have a deeper knowledge than do the human beings. And the tree of life, which now is going to be guarded, would be, and now they'll want to be immortal and live forever. So we're going to, this is a digression, but actually at the beginning of the story, there are two trees, the tree of the knowledge of good and bad, and the tree at the end of chapter 2, and the tree of life. In chapter 3, they merge into one tree because to eat off the tree of the knowledge of good and bad brings death. But at the end of the story, they're two separate trees again. That's part of the discussion about, and can an angel sin? Well, you got Lucifer and the others that were thrown out, right? It's not that God was lonely, but God wished to have, desired to have creatures, or in his thought process, to create beings who would be similar, would have personality, would have these other traits with whom God could commune in a special way, in a separate way, than the angels, because what are the angels? Excuse me, forgot. They're servants. They're servants, and there's a different relationship between creatures created to serve and human beings created not to be servants, though we offer our service to God as acceptable worship, our lives as acceptable worship, but not to be servants, but to have relationship in a different way. Adopted children, that kind of thing. You know, there's a difference in servant and family relationship. Oh, no, angels don't have souls. Per Christian theism and per much of Judaism, angels don't have a soul. Well, the soul of the Spirit, that's which gives life, is something that is where the God-breathed capacity comes in to human beings, as opposed to the angels that were created as they are to serve. God does not breathe into the angels the breath of life, and therefore they become living beings or living souls or living spirits. But does so with humans, because which connects in that special relationship. There's a spiritual capacity that we have for connection and for growth that the angels don't have. So the angel is a creature that's created to serve God ad infinitum. And in that role, ad infinitum. You know, speculation for the Jewish writer, the Hebrew writer here, is that the serpent, in fact, the Hebrew writer, the devil wasn't in the serpent. The serpent was a creature that was made by God, that was jealous of this relationship and got involved in all of this. And God allowed that to take place so that free choice would have to be exercised by the humans, by the man and the woman. Well, in the image of God, the image of God, as in, of course, you're dealing with the priestly account there, which is written much later in chapter 1, as opposed to the earlier written account in chapters 2 and following. And there are. But that. Yeah. Well, you know that. Well, it's but we give them the choice. You decide whether you're going to do what we say is best or not. But that's the thing. Well, we do have the choice. We can back off, but our human nature tends to overcome the better decision, and to do that, there's always the choice to make the best decision or the worst decision, or points in between. And while God may have known, well. Yeah. I mean, it's a matter of saying, you know, do this or don't do that. And God puts the garden, does the garden, puts a man in it, plants the tree, and then points the tree out. Which to me says right from the get-go, God intends for us to make our own decisions, and the only way that is love, to allow someone to make their own decisions, even though you know they may make the wrong decision. How many times have you told your children growing up? And your children who are even this tall, you know, really, you really don't need to do that. You need to do this because I've been there and I know you're going to. And what are they going to do? We have to let them make their own decision. And 8.5 times out of 10, at least, they're going to make that decision anyway. But they have to learn for themselves. God knowing to know ahead of time or is not the same as to predetermine what's going to happen. But God makes decisions, does God not? No, but he still makes decisions. He still has to make decisions. Am I going to do this or am I going to do that? Right? And he always chooses, you know, the good decision, but there's still the other decision that can be made. And so with that kind of capacity to make those decisions, presumably, ideally, we could have the opportunity to make the good decision all the time. But that's where we fight. There are, the Didache says there are two inclinations within every person, one good and one evil. And that the battle, the war, is constantly ongoing as to which one's going to win out in any given situation. That's the teaching of the 12 apostles, written non-canonical, but became kind of a manual of how to do communion and baptism and those kinds of things for a lot of folks. Yeah.
Here it is, right here. I'm pointing it out, you know. And then they say, don't show it. Don't
Well, yeah. And really, what? Right. Yeah. Turn away. Yeah, the rest, the majority of them went with the strangers. You're right. You know, you're given that. But lead us not into temptation. Actually, what Jesus is. Oh, I know. It is a struggle. Yeah. And then you might fall off a roller coaster in Disney World. Yeah. But you know, Jesus saying, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us. And it's a whole phrase, but deliver us from the evil one. Literally, it's the evil one, but evil. But it has a masculine singular ending. It's not, don't let us have temptation, but he's talking about, don't lead us into it, but lead us through it to the other side so we don't succumb. When temptation comes, lead us to the other side so we don't give in. Is what it really means. Well, but then again, that's true. And you drink your Evian water. Well, what's it backwards? Naive. Yeah. You actually believe it's pure. It comes from these pure springs.
Well.
Well, and the thing is, the thing about Susan, the thing about it seeming harder than it needs to be is, once again, if we are going to have free will and freedom to choose between not just good and evil, but shades of gray between good and evil, and nothing to do with the book. But, you know, there are all kinds of different shades in between there of what's better and better and best. If we're going to have that ability, then there has to be something to bounce that off of and say, okay, well, you know, what does it mean, good, if there's not something that's opposite? Probably one of the really interesting was in Oh God, Book 2, movie with George Burns. And the little girl who comes up, he is given the assignment by God to come up with some kind of slogan or something to really get people, and she and her friend come up with, Think God. You know, they're talking, she said, well, you know, what does God think? Think God. And so they do, and she's ridiculed and all, and she goes to run away. And God, a.k.a. George Burns, shows up in the bus station or the train station, I can't remember which one she's in, right in the seat beside her. Everybody's frantically looking for her and starts talking to her and eventually convinces her to go back. You know, he'll still be with her and all this kind of. And as they're walking away, she says, you know, I've got a question. He said, okay. He said, why do bad things happen? Why do children get sick with terrible diseases? And why do people die? And his response is thoroughly Jewish. And I don't know if this helps or not, but he says, go figure, it's George Burns. But he says, well, you know, I never could create anything with just one side. There's not a top without a bottom, a front without a back, pleasure without pain. How would you know if there wasn't the other side? And mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, it is supposed to be a circle of life. And there are some cultures, and there have been some cultures and religions in the world where the serpent wasn't necessarily the bad guy. And, you know, the year of the serpent in Chinese, you know, they have all these different cycles. You got the year of the monkey, which, you know, sometimes I think the world lives in a lot, but you know, all these different kinds of the year of the dog and everything, and the serpent has a different level as well. But Gene, that kind of depends on whether it's you look and say, okay, well, could this be allegorical, or yeah, it might seem weird, but in the beginning, how do we know that animals didn't talk and communicate? King's question was, wouldn't it be kind of strange anyway? You got a talking serpent?
And,
no. But here we've got this whole, the whole world is fallen. Why? Because people made certain decisions which affected not just humans. I mean, immediately it affects animals. If you continue to read the story, it says that, give me a break. Fig leaves are going to dry out pretty quickly, and you've got a stiff breeze. The text says here that God made for them clothes out of what? Animal skin. Now, I'm a hunter. Hunted most of my life. Have yet to figure out a way to get skin off the animal without the animal dying. Death entered the world, and God said death will enter the world. Death entered the world. Animals suffered the death. Now, humans eventually died, but they had to see what death was. I mean, how did they know what death was anyway before that, right? But they had to see what death was, experience it. But the rest of the world suffered. Why? Because of decisions that the man and the woman made. And so death did enter the world. It just took a while for it to enter it for them. But here, the whole thing is, we are part of this. And in the New Testament, Paul will talk about how the whole world groans and how the world, Christ will set everything right for the world and in the world. And we think, okay, that's with human beings. No, he's going to redeem the entire cosmos. And that's the whole thing in the book of Revelation about, figurative language, about the new heaven and the new earth, is that everything is made new. And when it says that, and the sea was, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and the sea was no more. That's a reference all the way back to Genesis with all the chaos in the beginning and everything. And what it's saying is that in the kingdom of God, everything that is frightening and chaotic and even the old enemies will be made right. Book of Isaiah, where and the little child shall lead them. Well, it talks about the lion lying down with the kid and all this kind of stuff. Those are enemies which will be set right when with Messiah. Yeah.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, decades ago, when my parents went to Japan for a month because of someone that had been an exchange student here, and his family, he was getting married, and his family had him come over. My mother walked into a public restroom, and there were men and women in there, and you didn't have stalls and seats. There was a trough in the middle of the floor, a porcelain trough in the middle of the floor that everyone used. And she turned around and walked out. Within Judaism, within most Christianity, actually within Zoroastrianism, which was a Western Persian religion, 500s B.C., and during the Persian Empire and the Persian period, the Hebrews, were there with the Persians, and the Persians said, go back and rebuild your cities, etc. And to an extreme in Islam, there's modesty about the body. The Romans didn't care so much about it. That's why when they crucified people, the loincloth in the paintings and on the crucifixes is for our benefit, because they wanted to totally embarrass Jews and anybody who had any kind of humility about the body. And Jesus was probably crucified totally naked. Mm-hmm. But well, even in time of Noah, people didn't believe the same.
Right. Well, I mean,
that's after that. But yes, Greeks did worship the body and nudity and those kinds of things. But yeah. Well, because it's at the time that this is written, within Judaism, obviously there's this sense of morality and this sense of Yeah, but there's this whole sense of property. Is, do what? Yeah. Well, they realized that it bothered them that they were naked. Before, it didn't bother them. But the whole idea here is that because of sin, you know, I sometimes tell folks, hey, you can thank Adam and Eve for clothes. You can also, I thank all these folks for the fact that now we can eat meat. But, I mean, before that, God said, eat the plants of the field. But I think, you know, this whole sense of morality, this whole sense of modesty and everything was an understanding from the Hebrew perspective that really there needed to be, along with decisions, there needs to be this sense of humility and morality and modesty in order to, because what it's very distracting for a number of folks, maybe not for everybody, but it's very distracting for a lot of folks it'd be very distracting to be on a nude beach for a lot of folks. That you know, that this is a proper sense of morality that God, and what that does is then that leads to even more temptation. And so, you know, this whole sense of modesty and what is proper was what the Hebrews understood as what God really intended. It, and it comes from a whole spiritual kind of thing. The image of God, that whole idea of spirit that does have a moral sense of what's right and wrong, etc. I mean, when you go back to this particular incident, there's been all kinds. Obviously, people have obviously said the most over the years that what happened in the fall was people learned the differences in the sex, had something to do with sex and sexuality. There was a 20th century rabbi, Gordas, that said, well, what happened was it was the difference in good love and bad love. Good love is heterosexual, bad love is homosexual. Now, how he jumped to that from this story, I don't know, but he did. Maimonides said that it was a fall from the perfect intellect, that actually being in the image of God was to be created in an intellectual image of God, that we were supposed to sit around and think nothing but grand metaphysical thoughts forever and that kind of thing, and then all of a sudden we had to think about practical issues. Carl Budd and Hermann Gunkel both said that what happened in the fall when the sin occurred was before that we were amoral. Humans were amoral. After this happened, the decision was made. Now we have no choice. We must make moral decisions. And even to choose not to make a decision is to choose in the wrong, because we're allowing the wrong to take to continue. So, I mean, this is volumes and volumes of books, libraries have been filled with discussions on just what does this mean, and that whole idea of original sin. Is original sin, are we all born with the taint of original sin? And is the taint of original sin that which is passed on through, in some of the early ideas, original sin was passed on through the blood in the birth process. Something in the blood and the flow of blood caused one to be unclean. Then later, the idea of original sin was this tendency to make the wrong decisions. And then we try to overcome it that way. You know, so you know, what is human nature? And what is human nature like? And these are, you know, what forms our external reality? One theologian writes that we are not created to be chaotic. There is supposed to be a uniformity within our lives and our relationships. While the system is open and not totally programmed, it is meant to be orderly, though not predestined. And if we find our place in that, then we will seek that which is orderly and within that which is orderly and which is within God's determinism as far as what is right and wrong. We can, you know.
And then you start having doubts. I know when I was a sermon, we had a ministerial student freshman year. And when he was a sophomore, he was an atheist. and then come back to the junior and senior year, he started coming back to his church, you know, things like that. But some people have to kind of get the mentality sometimes, you know, it's more than this, exactly what happens. You're 6,000 years old, you're older than that, and so forth and so on. And a lot of it doesn't matter when you get right down to it. It's kind of becomes pride.
Well, it can. I think the search for knowledge has to be tempered with a sense of responsibility. And therein lies the rub. Right. Right. Well, yeah.
Because I didn't have anybody leading me who could satisfactorily explain
that. Does it matter or not? Does it matter? And does it matter that in the resurrection accounts that none of them agree on anything except that Mary Magdalene was there and Jesus was resurrected from the dead? Because you got different numbers of angels or young man in white glowing clothing. You got the soldiers at one, but not in the other. You got earthquakes and dead people coming out of the tomb at one and not in the other, and you got different women that are supposedly there or not, and this kind of thing. But each is told, each of the Gospels is written with a particular audience in mind and from a particular perspective. I would be the one that would be, oh, wait a minute, something's wrong here, if reading the four Gospels and seeing that Matthew is writing for a particular audience, really, Jewish and Jewish Christian readers. Mark is writing for people being Christians being persecuted in Nero's Rome. Luke is for educated Gentiles, but also to show that Jesus came and God has a special concern for the outcasts, etc. John kind of catches everybody else in between. But you start reading all these and you see the different perspectives, and then all of a sudden you get to that pivotal moment, the resurrection, and all of a sudden every sentence, every word, everything's exactly the same. I say, somebody went through in these four things to make them read exactly the same. But each continues its own perspective on that. Now, if we were to leave here in a few moments, if we were to leave here in a few moments, and we walked, and we all walked out here, and we were talking, and car came flying down the hill, and another vehicle was coming this way, and they hit, and then the police show up, and they start asking questions. Well, what happened? How many different versions of that would we have? Yeah, as many people as are here. There would be details that some of us would grasp that others wouldn't, or would think that others wouldn't, but that still doesn't change. We all have our perspective, but that still doesn't change the fact of what happened. These two cars had this crash right here by us. And so the fact that the Gospels read differently in that really speaks more to the veracity than if all of a sudden everything is Stepford and reads exactly the same. That does sometimes upset, but I think knowledge, obviously, I think the search for knowledge goes on forever. Well, until you're alive. It's not alive any longer, but it has to be tempered with some sense of responsibility and that kind of thing. But, you know, when we talk about sin and its seriousness and everything, I have a quote here from Peanuts. Lucy. So, yeah, here we go. Well, you know, you do kind of look a little like Charlie Brown. From Peanuts to the Peanut Gallery. Lucy is talking to Charlie Brown at one point in time, and Lucy comes and says to Charlie Brown, "As your sister's consulting psychiatrist, I must put the blame for all of her fears on you." Charlie Brown says, "On me?" And Lucy says, "Yes, each generation must be able to blame the previous generation for its problems. It doesn't solve anything, but it makes us all feel better." And so, you know, sometimes that's what we try to do when we start looking at sin and human nature and all. Okay, well, and what was the man and what were Eve doing? It made him feel better to blame it on somebody else. Blame it on somebody else. And that's part of our human nature, too. But is that not part of free choice? God could have programmed and predetermined that we never made the wrong decisions. Everything we did would be right. But is that, my question there is that true love and care? True love risks. I bet you thought I was going to say true love waits. True love risks. Yeah, love never means never having to say you're sorry. Love story. But, you know, true love risks. Because love is only truly meaningful if it's decided upon. Is that not right? And so, God, even though God can look ahead and know what decision we're going to make and when we're going to make the right one and when we're going to make the wrong one, there's always, if God is love and God is a God of love, as biblical text says, and God is truly love, then love risks. Right, you can still know God. No. God does reveal himself and all. But God risks. And so part of this whole thing of our nature and human nature and our oftentimes propensity to make the wrong decision, because sin separates us from God, wrong decision separates us from God, but then again, sin separates us from each other too. Wrong decision separates us from each other. Is really, in some ways, as I said this morning about judgment, in some ways is an outpouring of God's love. Because God says, I'm going to love you enough to take this risk to allow you to make your decision, and even though I know there are going to be times that you're going to make the wrong decision, I love enough to know that even though you do that, this is the right thing to do if love is to be genuine. And a lot of times we don't learn as much in the journey this way as we learn when we put our hand on the burner or we do something else and make the wrong decision. And that's where it doesn't kill us if we're not part of the Darwin Awards. That's where even in the judgment we can find room to give thanksgiving for God loving us enough. Of course, we don't often think of that. Saying, why didn't you keep me from doing that? Well, because then it wouldn't be love. We have all kinds of examples, all kinds of teachings, all kinds of words from God and through others, God through others, to tell us what the right decisions to make are. But then again, we've got to make that decision. And in that, we eventually prove our love as well by deciding to follow what is best. And we prove it when we say, okay, I really would rather you do this. And here's my advice. And I'm going to watch you and wish I could protect you, but I'm going to let you make your decision. And try as hard as we might, we cannot live our children's lives for them. We can't live our grandchildren's lives for them. All we can do is the best that we can do in seeking to guide them and teach them and help them and in hope and pray that they make the right decision. At the same time, knowing that there'll be a lot of times they won't make the right decision. And then the question is, what do we do? I don't have all the answers by any means. Sin creates death within ourselves. Sometimes, as Tillich says, sometimes, when our human nature, we allow it to become so fallen that we continue in sin, it creates death within ourselves, death of our own self-esteem, death of our relationships, death of our spirit. But the good news can be, or is, that there can be life even after death if we find our way back, because God's in the business of resurrection, correct? Even from bad decisions. we keep plugging along, and we got a whole lot more that we'll look at in a couple of weeks. But I really like it when we have give and take, and when y'all ask questions, and when people talk. And I'm really working hard not to interrupt, although I know I'm not all that successful. But I hope that some of these discussions are helpful, because there are a lot of folks out there. The other day I was changing the channels on the radio and ran across a station which I don't normally listen to. It's an upstate station. But I heard all this back and forth vitriol on this Christian station. And so I listened for about 10 minutes. That's all I could stand, because I found my blood pressure going up. And, you know, each one was saying they were Christian, and yet they were on opposite sides and throwing flaming spears at each other, not just darts. And I thought, they were talking past each other. That we need more talking with each other than talking past. A lot of times that's... That's a lot of our problem, is we talk past rather than with. And to talk with means that we talk some and we listen some. Right? But I thank y'all. And it's 7 minutes to seven. God bless you. Go in peace. And have a good Thanksgiving week. Can't emphasize enough, please be careful. Amen.